So we'll start with a story from Ajahn Chah. You know Ajahn Chah? Everyone should know Ajahn Chah. He's just one of those people you'd want to know. He's actually not alive anymore, but that's okay. We can all know Ajahn Chah. So the word Ajahn means teacher in Thailand, and then different versions of that word in the Theravada tradition. And Chah was his given name. And he's one of our late great masters. So his teacher was Ajahn Mun, and Ajahn Mun's teacher was Ajahn Sao. And Ajahn Sao and Ajahn Mun were some of the great revolutionaries in our tradition out of Thailand. And what happened during their era, which of course was a number of generations ago, is that the tradition had become very heady. You know, us Americans are not the first people to have this issue of it becoming a little bit too heady. And so Buddhism in Thailand had become primarily a scholarly tradition. So there was great study happening, but very little practice. And actually, the meditation part of the tradition was dying out. And so these late great masters had an intuition that direct experience was imperative in terms of keeping liberation alive on the planet. And so they left the monasteries and they left the scholarly schools and they went out into the forests of Thailand, and specifically northern Thailand. And this was back in the days when there were 70 to 80% more forests in northern Thailand. They're being taken out really fast. And there were definitely tigers and poisonous snakes and everything else that you would find in the jungle at that time. And they went out. And they went out with this passion in their hearts for direct experience of freedom. Not something that they wanted to hear about, not something they wanted to study about, not something they wanted to theorize about, but a direct experience. And through their direct experiences of liberation, this thread that now has been passed down into our own tradition here in the West and in America was re-energized. So it's really important to know in our path of practice that we're part of a living lineage. I said this before, these teachings, the direct experience of them, the language that we humbly try to put on something that is beyond language, is being passed person to person to person. And so Ajahn Chah was a tremendous influence on a couple of different teachers, both East and West, who were very strong influences on me in my early practice. And so it goes, person to person. So it's just a little moment with Ajahn Chah, and there were so many little moments with Ajahn Chah. One of the things that I love about him is that he was so serious about waking up on one hand, but he was also playful and a trickster and, you know, would often pull the rug out and then giggle. And there's something about that in my own being that really resonates. So here's one of many, many moments like this with Ajahn Chah, a Western student who was a beginning meditator, came to see Ajahn Chah, and he came to see Ajahn Chah with a question, as many Westerners did, were full of questions. And Ajahn Chah was pretty generous in answering them. And so the question on this particular day was, what is the teaching that you give to beginning meditators to help them free their minds? What should I be doing? And Ajahn Chah's response was, well, actually, what I say to beginning meditators is the exact same thing as I say to senior meditators, people who've been meditating for quite some time. And I just imagine this young Westerner having the thought, wow, I'm going to get this special teaching for the senior students, and I just started out. And I could imagine this person on the edge of their heels, because they probably weren't sitting in a chair because they would want to be lower than Ajahn Chah, to be respectful. So sitting on the edge of their heels, what is it going to be? And you know what the answer was? just keep going. Whether you're brand new, whether you've been doing this forever, just keep going. So we'll travel back to the time of the Buddha, right after the Buddha's awakening. And right after the Buddha's awakening, a number of things happened. Those of us that went on the pilgrimage or that have kind of studied the period after the Buddha's awakening remember that he spent a number of weeks in the area of the Bodhi tree, in what is now known as Bodh Gaya, India, sitting under various different trees, you know, basking in the bliss of awakening, kind of fine-tuning his conceptual understanding of what had transpired in direct experience, having questions about what I've experienced, could anybody grok this? And coming to the conclusion that no, nobody could grok this. And then having an unseen benevolent force come down and say, actually, Venerable Sir, you are wrong. There are those with little dust in their eyes. They could understand this. And the Buddha going, huh, okay, well, so who could understand this? And he had a memory of several different people who had since passed. And then he realized that his five friends that he practiced with before he went to the Bodhi tree were still alive. However, they were not in Bodh Gaya. They were in Saranath. So we remember from the pilgrimage that that was a half a day train ride away after we took a car ride, right? And the Buddha walked barefoot, wandering by stages to the place where his five friends were in the hopes that he might be able to offer something of his own experience to them. On the way, he ran into a number of different people. And one of the people that he ran into was a Brahmin by the name of Upaka. And when Upaka saw the Buddha walking down the road barefoot, him among all the other travelers on that road caught his attention. And in part, the Buddha caught Upaka's attention because of the great discrepancy between the rags that he was wearing and his bearing and his countenance. So he was dressed in rags, and yet his bearing was that of a noble being. And in part, that's the conditioning of his youth in a noble family. And then his countenance was shining. It was just shining with light. I wonder how many of us have run across somebody, something like that. Not like the Buddha, but you know how when you're just wandering through the world, every once in a while you walk past somebody and you do a double take, not because they're physically beautiful, but because there's something beautiful shining out of them? You go, wow, they've got something. So Upaka had that with the Buddha. Wow, he's got something. And he stopped the Buddha on the path and he said, Venerable Sir, who are you? And then he started asking questions. Are you a Brahmin, which is kind of like a higher caste, right, in India? And the Buddha said, no. And are you a god? And the Buddha said, no. Are you a deva? And the Buddha said, no. And he asked several more questions, and the answer was no. And finally, in just exasperation, Upaka kind of threw up his hands and said, well, who are you? And the Buddha looked at him straight in the eye and answered, I am awake. I am awake. At which point, Upaka did something interesting, which was kind of looked at the Buddha in a perplexed way, shook his head, and said something akin to, good luck to you, sir, and actually took off in a different direction. Okay? So we've got folks running around on the planet right now who say, I am Jesus Christ, and I am, you know, some rock star, I am this, I am that. So all of this, and the misperception of this, was going on at the time of the Buddha. And so Upaka just thought, oh, this is another freak on the road who thinks they're fully awakened, and went by a different path. So I imagine, although we don't know exactly, that the Buddha's response to this was to continue wandering down the road, obviously, because he got to Sarnath at some point. And to kind of shake his head and go, well, that didn't work so well. I wanted to clear the dust out of this man's eyes, and instead he looked perplexed and took off in a different direction. That wasn't a successful strategy. And so as he was walking, by the time he got to his five friends, he had come up with a much more successful strategy. And it's one that's been serving us generation by generation, person by person, to this very day. It's the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And so I imagine if the Buddha lived in modern times and had a modern mind, and which he didn't and he wasn't, that kind of perspective, he would have done something like wander down the road and go, okay, that didn't work so well, so what might work? Oh, maybe I need a formula. Well, let me see. Life is difficult. Yeah, people could connect with that. You know, everyone has had some difficulty. Let's start with that. Life is difficult. And then people will probably want to know why it's difficult. So I'll come up with the second noble truth, right? First noble truth, life is difficult. Second noble truth, there's a cause for this difficulty. This basic struggle, craving, wanting it to be other. Oh, but then I should really tell them that there's a way out so they don't get discouraged. Okay, that'll be the third piece. Peace is possible. There's the cessation of the struggle with the difficulty. Oh, and then I should give them some tools. And maybe, you know, I mean, I'm just improvising here, right? It's like, how did this happen? This is an alive tradition. Maybe a cart rolled by, and he saw the wheel, and he thought, oh, I'll make up a set of tools on the eight spokes of the wheel. Mm-hmm. And it'll be helpful for people. And there's the fourth strategy. And he got to Sarnath, and his friends saw him coming and went, oh, there's that slacker Siddhartha, who ate too much food and stopped doing the real practice that we were doing. We're not going to make a seat ready for him, and we're not going to make him welcome. But in fact, as the Buddha got closer, the same thing happened as happened to Upaka. And there was something shining forth, and they just couldn't help themselves. And so in fact, they scurried around and made a seat ready and helped him wash his feet. He'd come a long way and sat down and paid him respects. They understood that something had changed in their friend, the slacker. This is such a good lesson to not hold on to views and opinions. John was talking about views and opinions last night. What if they'd held on to their views and opinions about Siddhartha the slacker? They would have missed that moment. How many moments of teaching, much less how many moments of awakening, have we missed in our lives because we held dear to the view and opinion that allowed that circumstance or that person to not be the teacher of the moment? So they were open, and the Buddha gave a much more eloquent description than I just did of the Four Noble Truths, and the awakening process began. So this evening, I'd like to primarily pick up where John left off last night with the theme of awareness and explore that with a simple map and also some indirect experience so that we can just have some sense of the doorways in. There's so many doorways into this. It's not really an experience, but this quality that we name awareness. And the thing is that different teachers use this word in different ways. And in fact, I'm going to use it slightly differently than John is. There isn't a real conflict, although between all the different teachers and all the different traditions that I've heard about, received teachings and studied, and sometimes there can be quite a divergence around this word awareness. And so it's extremely important to know that every tradition has teachings on awareness. It's not belonging to insight meditation or to the Thai Forest tradition, which is kind of my main lineage line, or the tradition out of Burma has their own teachings on awareness, Sri Lanka, the Zen tradition, the Tibetan traditions. You know, they've all got it. So there must be something to it. I'll tell you what really helped me decrease the level of confusion and struggle around language with some of these more subtle teachings and practices. And this dates me. But it's Star Trek. Okay? And so at the time that this came to me, Star Trek Voyager was still on. So that tells you how long ago this was. And I was struggling with some of the language of various teachings and basically just getting my mind in a spin, which was leading to confusion, which then led to doubt, and then led to kind of sometimes giving up or sometimes just getting a little bit too caught up in it instead of just surrendering to what was available to be known. And I thought to myself at one point as I was struggling really hard with language and theory and terms, you know, I just need a universal translator. You know, Star Trek, how there's completely different, not just cultures, but life forms. And the Star Trek Voyager would pop out of warp speed and, like, stop in the middle of space. And then this other ship would come out of warp speed and stop in the middle of space. And then they needed transporters, which I can't quite figure out how to pull that one off. I would love to. I'm waiting for that. And my concentration is not quite high enough to double myself or any of these things that are the possibility of high concentration. And then they'd have their universal translator, where the alien being would say, and the Star Trek Voyager crew would be able to understand it, and then they'd speak in American English, and they'd be able to understand it, and all worked out. Why am I telling you this? Because I'd really, really like to encourage all of us, not just tonight, but all the way through the practice path, to improv, to be creative. When a word catches you up, put it down and find a word that's the doorway in. The practice itself will reveal if the word is a little bit off through direct experience. We don't have to worry about it. We find our own language. It's really helpful and empowering process. So the map is a map based on direct experience. It's got four parts, and it comes out of the tradition of the forest of southern Thailand. One of the teachers I trained with in my early years of practice. It's got four parts. I'm going to say it in the Pali first because that's how I learned it. And I'll translate it into different versions of English, which you can continue translating. So here's the four. The first one is Sati. The second one is Maha Sati. Third is Satipanya. And the fourth is Panya Vimutti. Isn't it beautiful language? Sati, Mahasati, Satipanya, Panya Vimutti. So what does it mean? Sati, mindfulness. It's a Pali word for mindfulness. Mahasati means great mindfulness. And we're going to talk about what makes it great. But we're already starting to point to a progression that it's just like with the heart practices. We all have ordinary levels of expression and experience of friendliness, of empathy, of joy, of balance of mind. And then they mature and they grow. Okay, so Mahasati, great mindfulness. Satipanya is mindfulness wisdom. So now it's starting to get more mature. This is a process of how mindfulness matures. And then Panya Vimutti is the wisdom that leads to letting go, the wisdom that leads to release. And how does that work? So we have Sati, Mahasati, Sati Panya, and Panya Vimutti. So we'll start with Sati. We know this one well. It's the world of mindfulness and the objects of mindfulness, right? It's the world of objects and the knowing of objects. So let me first introduce you to Upasika Ki. Upasika Ki has also passed away, but she passed away only about 25 years ago. And she was one of the great teachers in Thailand of the last century. What's unusual about that is that she was a woman. And very much in the Thai Force tradition, it's a patriarchal tradition. And so I've been quite interested, and it's been very important in my own practice path, to research where were the women masters in this tradition. And she was one. She is actually a laywoman. She never took monastic ordination, but she did take 8 precepts. So the 8 precepts are the 5 that we practice, plus additional not eating a meal after noon, not adorning the body or engaging in entertainments, not sleeping on high or luxurious beds or oversleeping. Those were her precepts. And she's quite an inspiration and really, really freed her mind. So the way that it's said was that she wasn't just the greatest woman teacher in Thailand of the last century, but she was actually one of the greatest teachers, period. She definitely doesn't pull her punches, so be ready. Here's one of her comments on mindfulness, how to begin to practice mindfulness. She really doesn't start at the beginning. For mindfulness, start out by brushing aside all external concerns and turn to look inside at your own mind until you know in what ways it is clear or murky, calm or unsettled. To do this, put mindfulness and alertness in charge as you keep aware of the body and mind until you've trained the mind to stay firmly in a state of normalcy or neutrality. Okay, that's step one. Put aside your concerns. Good luck. It's okay to put them aside and then pick them up again. You know, it's a habit. And we're going to talk about that when we get to the letting go process. Because letting go works on a continuum as well. I want to retranslate this word neutrality, because I think what she's pointing to is non-reactivity. Until the mind reaches a state of non-reactivity. And she's actually calling that a fundamental normalcy. It's a normalcy outside of our dis-ease of reactivity, drama, and freaking out. Okay? So, we'll start with that. Maybe we need an analogy. Talk a little bit more about mindfulness. So we know that the mindfulness is a present moment, intentional, non-judgmental attention, moment by moment. An analogy that I really like to describe this process and some of the parts of it very much works here on the islands is the analogy of paddling and floating. Okay, so sometimes in mindfulness practice, we need to be paddling. So we've got mindfulness, we've got an object. Primary object for most of us is either the breath or sounds coming and going. Call that a primary object. It's the default. When in doubt, we go back there. Then we've got a whole bunch of other objects, like in addition to sound, sight, smells, taste, the sense doors, the mind, emotions, thoughts, and the rest. And they're all available to be aware of. So we're paddling along. We're using tools and techniques. We're noting. We're counting. We're investigating. We're coming back. We're inquiring. Paddling along, right? So that's an important part of mindfulness. But the reason I like the analogy of paddling and floating is that it's sometimes easy to forget with all these techniques and the trying to get it right and all of this, that in fact there are moments when it's time to just stop paddling, roll over and float down the river of awareness. And it's less about techniques, and it's less about what we're being aware of, and it's more about the knowing quality itself. And that's restful and easeful, and we can gather momentum. We need to develop a certain amount of concentration before we can roll over and rest in the knowing. Because otherwise, it'll be really brief. So brief, and there's so little charge on it, that we'll probably miss it. And think, huh, am I bored? Was I spacing out? What's going on here? Okay. So first we paddle. We develop momentum in the mind, mindfulness and concentration, or sati samadhi. Then we roll over and flow. So here's a way of looking at it from Ajahn Chah. First one learns the Dharma, but does not yet understand it. Then one understands, but is not yet practiced. One practices, but has not yet seen the truth of the Dhamma. Then one sees the Dhamma, but one's being has not yet become the Dhamma. And what this points to are three insights that come out of the Four Noble Truths, right? Life isn't easy. It doesn't help that we struggle. Peace is possible. There are tools to cultivate this peace. Different way of translating the Four Noble Truths. I could translate it 15 different ways. Find your own language so you can remember it and reflect on it, use it in direct experience, and then know what you know. So these are the three insights. First, we have to reflect, to know enough that, oh, counting breaths helps. Oh, orienting to the Four Noble Truths helps. We reflect. Then we have a direct experience. That's the second form of insight. And that's not theoretical. We're not thinking about it. It's actually happening here and now. The way it's put is to be experienced individually by the wise. And then the third piece is often translated into knowing what we know. And I thought that would be an interesting one, given that we've been talking so much about don't know mind. Because on one hand, don't know mind. We don't want to become the one that knows how to do this practice, that knows awareness, that knows our own awakeness and freedom, and like, I know. You're following me, right? That energetic. It's tight. It's limited. I've just concretized everything that might lead to more freedom. Okay? But actually, knowing what we know in the sense of, ah, this has been understood, is helpful. Because on the other side of knowing too much and needing don't know mind, I see way too many students of the Dharma, and this has happened to me, where out of almost like a false humility or some subtle doubt that remains, we don't acknowledge fully what is known. It's not me that knows it, but it is understood. It's okay to know what we know. And then we open to the don't know of the mystery of, and what? We don't concretize it. We just open to it. So here's one of my dear friends in the Dhamma. And she's actually quite well known these days. She wasn't so much when we became friends. Her name is Aya Totoloka. She's one of the great elders, American-born, in our tradition these days. She's actually the first American fully ordained woman monastic in our tradition. And the woman's line of fully ordained monasticism in our tradition died out for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's being rekindled. And so as the first American woman to be fully ordained, she now ordains other women at great cost. At great cost, there's a lot of controversy about this. But she's fearless, and I love her. So here's what she has to say. Not just to hear the teachings, but to learn how to do that with the body and heart, feeling it deeply in the body, down into the cells, from a single thought, a single perception. We are able to see the truth only through what we have going on. This is what we've got. So mindfulness. Then we have mahasati, great mindfulness. So the obvious question is, what makes it great? Oh, and let's get something really, really clear here. This list of four It's really easy out of our conditioning to think that it's a linear progression. It is not. It circles, it doubles back on itself, it makes a leap. But it is the process of how the mind matures, how the mindfulness matures. So what makes Mahasati Mahasati, or great mindfulness? A few different ways to translate this. Sustained mindfulness, pure knowing, pure awareness, or sometimes it's put mindfulness of emptiness. So now we need to go back to this word emptiness, which catches so many of us up, and go back to what John was saying this morning. I translate it a little bit differently, but it's as if there's a bowl, right? And the bowl has a form, but inside the bowl it's empty, right? And because it's empty, it's pregnant with possibility. That's the way I kind of translate it, just pregnant with possibility. I could put it on my head, I could use it as a bell, I could use it as a flower pot, and on and on and on. So it has potential. And it has potential because I'm not locked into the solidity of views and opinions and me in relationship to. It's open. Ajahn Buddhadasa, another late master from southern Thailand, puts it this way. Emptiness and mindfulness are one. And I remember one of my own Western teachers. I remember this because of his excitement. It was just a simple conversation. It happened so many years ago. But I remember it because of the look in his eye and the excitement on his face. And he was talking to me a little bit about his own practice in relation to my practice. And he said, "You know what I'm excited about these days?" He said, "When I was younger in practice, I was excited about mindfulness and developing mindfulness with all things." He said, "And that was great." And then he got this gleam in his eye, and he said, "These days, I'm excited about mindfulness of emptiness." And I looked at him, and I had no idea what he was talking about. And my jaw kind of dropped open, and I'm like... It was funny, I didn't even ask him what it meant. I just looked at him and went, uh-huh. There was some understanding in me that it just, in that moment for me, it wasn't an appropriate time to ask a theoretical question and get a verbiage answer. I wanted to sit with him in the field of what he was understanding without me needing to understand it. So that might be a possibility for you tonight. There's a word in Thai, puru, and Ajahn Sumedho, who is kind of our... Ajahn Chah transmitted the lineage to Ajahn Sumedho, who is also an American, and he brought it to the West and started the Western Thai forest monasteries. So he translates this word puru as consciousness knowing. Consciousness knowing, or person knowing. And it's this word that often gets translated from Ajahn Chah as the one who knows. Those of us that know the teachings of Ajahn Chah know that his favorite thing to talk about is the one who knows, which is really, really confusing in American English because it looks like it's referring to someone. And it's actually kind of a poor translation of this puru, which is pure knowing, consciousness knowing. How about instead of the one who knows, that which knows? That which knows. So, instead of talking more about it, thought we'd practice a little bit with it and just offer a few very simple doorways in that maybe one of them you'll play with during the rest of the retreat. And I want to make it clear that the play that we're about to do here, they're just doorways. They're techniques that are the finger pointing at the moon. I'm not saying that these techniques are awareness or anything else. I'm just saying that what I've noticed through my own practice and through supporting other people to mature mindfulness and open to this quality that we call awareness, that these seem to be helpful doorways some of the time. Okay? But it's not as if we're going, if I only do this, then I got it. Finger pointing to the moon. So the first invitation is actually to allow the eyes to close. And maybe taking a few deeper breaths, just to bring in some spaciousness into the body and settling of the body. And there's the possibility as we sit here in a relaxed way, because this isn't special. We actually already know this. So we're just hanging out, taking a breath in and taking a breath out. And there's the possibility of inviting softening, and specifically beginning to soften around the eyes. So we can soften the muscles around the eyes. We can allow the eyeballs themselves to soften and see if you can just feel them fall back a little bit into the eye socket and just rest. Sometimes even with eyes closed, we're looking for something. Just let them rest. There's nothing to seek. And even with the eyes closed, we can invite the peripheral vision to be open. See what the experience is of that for you with eyes closed. Can relax the inner ear. And for some of us, by softening the gaze, even with eyes closed, relaxing the inner ear, there's this experience in a moment, or more sustained, of a little more spaciousness. In many traditions, this quality of spaciousness is said to be a cousin of awareness, or one of the reflections of awareness. As we continue to soften the gaze and let the inner ear relax and open, we can begin to take in sounds. The sounds which are moving through space and being known. We can start to get curious about that which knows the sounds. Simple experience of awareness. For some of us, there can be at times access to what is called in the tradition out of Thailand, the sound of silence. And the sound of silence does not require sounds to cease to be available to be known. Can look and see if, how it's available now. And the rest of the sounds will come back in the foreground at times, and we just relax back again. And open to either the sound of silence or that which is knowing the sounds. We can return the attention to the experience of breath being known. This beautiful anchor we return to again and again, always available to be known. So allowing the mindfulness to reconnect with the stream of sensations that we label breath. Maybe even using a few tools, like noting the rising and the falling, or counting a few breaths, and letting those mental notes be so quiet in the background, mostly the sensations of breath. We're going to switch it around, and we're going to invite the sensations of breath to rest back in the background of attention. It's still happening, still knowing, but quiet in the background, and invite into the foreground of attention that which knows the breath. Even just for a moment before the mind goes, what is that? Just invite it again, that which knows the breath in the foreground. We'll open the eyes. And when we do, the invitation is actually to take in space. The eye lands so quickly on all the objects here. Just for a moment, allow the space to be in the foreground. It helps to have the peripheral vision be open when we open the eyes. The gaze be soft and big, and there's the space, and it too can be known. can even pendulate back and forth a little between the eye landing on something that's a more solid appearing object, and then just kind of bring the gaze back and take in space. Move back and forth, play around. So, sati, mindfulness, mahasati, great mindfulness, pure knowing, pure awareness. And then we have satipanya, or mindfulness wisdom. So, at this point, we're starting to actually work with some of the deeper conditioning of what we call the defilements, or the coloring of the glasses. Remember when I was talking about the glasses that we put on, and, you know, they tend to be colored with things like the fear glasses, or the angry glasses, or the I want everything glasses, or it's all about me glasses. All these glasses, right? And they're colored. They're colored. Through the awareness becoming more and more clear, more and more mature, there's the potential for the glasses to start to get cleared out. It's a way to actually clean the lens of the glasses. We don't know how to do that on our sunglasses or our reading glasses or whatever. How do we do that with the mind? Well, through the exact same practices that we're doing, wisdom starts to increase. And wisdom specifically in three ways. And we've been talking about them the whole retreat. We'll just name them. The first one is that everything changes. The second one is that when we hold on, it hurts. And the third one is, it is not personal. We're all going through this. So the Pali, just because I'm using some Pali tonight, is anicca, dukkha, and anatta, or impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And these just start to grow in ordinary ways, through direct experience. They couldn't not. We go on a big goose chase after it. Where's that not self thing? But then we're chasing after an experience. It's just, oh, I relaxed around the drama a little bit. Not selfing is a verb. And in fact, probably you're noticing this, awareness is a verb. It's not a noun. If it's a noun, it's so much easier for it to get solid, right? It's awarenessing. This is awareness. So let's share a little more from Upasaka Ki, just to keep the bar high. Okay. So the mind is now in a state of normalcy through mindfulness, right? Non-reactivity. Okay. Once the mind can stay in a state of normalcy, you'll see mental fabrications and preoccupations in their natural state of arising and passing. The mind will be empty, neutral, and still, neither pleased nor displeased, and will see physical and mental phenomena as they arise and disband naturally of their own accord. Even right now, say you've got some discomfort, you've been sitting here a while. You can experience it as an ongoing, nightmarish event, or you could experience it as like, oh, a little more pulling, a little more heat, a little more aversion in the mind. Oh, cleaning the glasses, a little bit less. Arising and disbanding. This is on unsatisfactoriness. She says, mindfulness and discernment are tools for knowing ourselves, for testing ourselves, so we won't be careless or complacent, oblivious to the fact that suffering is basically what life is all about. This point is something we have to really comprehend so that we can live without being oblivious. I know we're here to not live being oblivious. We've missed so many amazing moments of life because we weren't quite there. We're here to cultivate the here-ness. So what she has to say about not self. when the knowledge that there is no self or not self to any of these experiences becomes thoroughly clear, you will meet with something that lies further inside, beyond all suffering and stress, free from the cycles of change, free from birth as well as death. For all things that take birth must by nature age, grow ill, and die. When you see this truth clearly, you will not hold on to anything. So she just took it all the way up the scale. Not just a little less drama. Not just a little less reactivity. Not just getting over yourself, like John likes to say. But how that actually leads to complete freedom. And that is a process too. So let's talk about that process. The wisdom starts to increase through the understanding of what we call the three characteristics. Everything changes. When we hold on, it hurts. It's not personal. Those three understandings, again and again and again. And then we move into the Panya Vimutti, or the letting go, the release. The wisdom leads to letting go. So how does that work? Go back to Ajahn Chah, who's got a famous quote that actually works really well as a metaphor for practice. The quote is this: if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. Mm-hmm. If you let go completely, you'll have complete peace. So that's beautiful and easy to remember. Because it's easy to remember, I've really reflected on using it as a metaphor for practice and how release works. Because it's not one release. The same way as in the forgiveness practice, we don't forgive once. It's a process. It's a verb. So let's start with, if you let go a little, you have a little peace. Okay, I need a prop. Here's a prop. So let's shake the sentient beings off this prop so that they don't suffer. Okay. So we've got a prop, and you know, if you've got a tissue or a shawl or an edge of something that you want to play with this with in direct experience, so you're not just watching me and it's not just theoretical, feel free, but no pressure, right? So we've got a tissue or a cloth or something, and we're going to grab that thing the way that we grab onto our deepest habit patterns and me and my drama, and we're going to grab a hold of that thing as if, like, life will end if we don't hold on. And the reason that it helps to actually do this is to feel it in the body. You know, it's like, feel that grab. So right now, we're holding on. Okay? Now, if I had us hold on to this thing for the next hour very, very tightly, it would hurt. It would hurt a lot, and we would understand unsatisfactoriness, right? But we won't do that. So the first thing we're going to do is let go a little, which is just hold on to the thing, but like open your fist a little bit so it doesn't hurt so much. This is let go a little. This is when we get really, really caught up in something and we have that beautiful moment of a mindful pause where we go, oh, take a breath, this is hard. Or that moment of metta or something, we're letting go a little. But then often the momentum of the foot on the gas pedal of the habit pattern is so strong that we grab on again. Okay. So now we've grabbed on again. But we know what's next. We're going to let go a lot. So if we let go a lot, we're actually dropping this thing into our lap, and we get to feel the release. There's space. It's pregnant with possibility of not that habit pattern. Okay? Not that solid, contracted, right? But we've just let go a lot. We haven't let go completely. So due to causes and conditions, we're going to grab it again because it's a habit. We can't help it. So we've now grabbed it again, even though we let go of it a lot, right? And here we are, grabbing on, grabbing on, grabbing on. Now when we uproot, when we transform, when we've completely burned out the struggle around some object, then we let go completely. And that thing falls, and there's just no impulse to pick it up again. The hand is free. The hand is free to offer comfort to another, to offer comfort to ourselves, to do something functionally helpful. It's free and available. So that's a metaphor. But it works. I track it in my own practice. This is holding on. This is letting go a little. This is letting go a lot. This is letting go completely. It's like this. So these levels of release. Be on the lookout for release. Release happens all the time. Ordinary ways, extraordinary ways, all the time. So let's hear about Upasaka Ki's final release. It's a favorite enlightenment story of mine. One night I was sitting in meditation outside in the open air, just like us. My back as straight as an arrow, firmly determined to make the mind quiet. But even after a long time, it wouldn't settle down. So I thought, I've been working at this for many days now, and yet my mind won't settle down at all. It's time to stop being so determined and simply be aware of the mind. I started to take my hands and feet out of the meditation posture. But at the moment that I had unfolded one leg, but had yet to unfold the other, I could see that my mind was like a pendulum swinging more and more slowly, more and more slowly, till it stopped. The still point. Then there arose an awareness that was sustained by itself. Slowly, I put my hands and feet back into position. At the same time, the mind was in a state of awareness, absolutely and solidly still, seeing clearly into the elementary phenomenon of existence as they arose and disbanded in their nature, and also seeing a separate condition inside with no arising, no disbanding, no changing, a condition beyond birth and death, something very difficult to put clearly into words because it was a realization of the elementary phenomenon of nature, completely internal and individual. There's many ways of experiencing freedom as there are those of us on this planet. The world needs each of our expressions of freedom. In the ordinary, in the extraordinary. I'm going to close with one of my favorite quotes by Ajahn Sumedho. Awareness is your refuge. Awareness of the changingness of feelings, of attitudes, of moods, of material change and emotional change. Stay with that, because it's a refuge that is indestructible. It's not something that changes. It's a refuge you can trust in. This refuge is not something you create. It's not a creation. It's not an ideal. It's very practical and very simple, but easily overlooked or not noticed. When you're mindful, you're beginning to notice. It's like this. It's just like this. Small moments, many times. Just like this. So that's what I have to offer for reflection. And thank you for your attention.